Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 1st of April. The experience of war this hour, particularly the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, will have several guests with us during the course of the hour. Phil Clay is going to be here. Phil is the author of a book that's just getting rave reviews. Redeployment is the name of it, and it's 12 stories, all told in the voice of soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our guest has written profoundly about war and about bridging a divide that exists between those who serve and those who seek to understand what it's like to serve. He will be with us momentarily. A little bit later in this hour, we'll be speaking with two Milwaukee vets who went on this very, very long walk from Milwaukee all the way to Los Angeles. They left last year and they returned early in February. They went for a couple reasons. One, to work out the cobwebs in their minds, the post-traumatic stress that they were experiencing, giving them time to think about their war experience. And they met a lot of vets along the way. They were filmed by documentary filmmakers. And they also were raising money for an organization here in Milwaukee that provides services for veterans. So it should be quite a good hour. And you are welcome to join this conversation. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Phil's book has been just receiving, as I said, wonderful reviews. And the Library Journal said that it was harrowing at times, blackly comic at others. The author's first collection could become for the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts what Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried is for the Vietnam War. His writing and his work has been compared to Joseph Heller, to George Orwell. So he's on his way as a writer. The book is Redeployment. Phil is a Dartmouth graduate, a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. He served in Iraq during the surge in Anbar Province as a public affairs officer, later received an MFA from Hunter College, attended NYU Veterans Writing Workshop, and he has written for the New York Times, the New York Daily News, and his work has appeared in Best American Non-Required Reading 2012. Hello, Phil. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, this is something, your first work, and look at what people are saying about you. You obviously have thought long and hard, not only about your experience, but you have thought about the experience of war forevermore, since time began almost, haven't you? You've thought deeply about it.
Well, I spent a lot of time. The book took me about 4 years to write. Mm. And, of course, I was in the Marine Corps before that, and reading war fiction and books about war and, mm-hmm. and the experience of what it is. Part of writing the book was just an attempt to try and think about what it meant on a human level for a lot of the different types of people, engaged in the Iraq War.
Yeah. The book is dedicated to your mom and dad, who you write had three sons who joined the military in a time of war. Three sons. Oh, my goodness, what your mom and dad must have gone through.
Well, they had five sons total. So
oh, my.
Three who joined the military certainly didn't make it easy on them.
No, I'm sure that it didn't. You have a really interesting piece in the New York Times that I just thought was really profound, because I've interviewed so many vets over many years of doing interviews, and I'm mm-hmm. sure that I have said, and people say all the time to you, I can never imagine what you've been through. It's a whole band of brothers. It's an experience that's something that only vets can understand. And you talk about how important it is for, one of the reasons for the book, I'm sure, for all of us to have an understanding of what it is.
Absolutely. And I think that, the assumption that war experience is incommunicable, that you can't talk about it, that, people who haven't been there don't understand, it makes it very abstract, and it also makes it somewhat isolating. And I think that, the way that we as human beings deal with what we've been through and come to kind of get some sort of understanding of it is through sharing that experience with others.
Mm-hmm. And yet some of what you write about, I must be honest with you, it is very, very hard to read. It's the kind of, but I'm squeamish about anything that's got horror in it. But it is filled with, you know, shooting dogs and body parts and, I mean, just the horrible things that you just don't want to ever imagine can happen in life.
Right. I mean, you can't talk about war in general, or certainly not the Iraq War, without dealing with some very, very hard subjects.
Right. And why is it important for all of us to read that then? Why is it important? Is it because we send people to war that we need to know what it is?
Well, yeah, this is what we make as a country, right? You know, it's not like the military decides to up and go to war on their own. You know, as citizens, we're ultimately responsible for what our country does. We elect the leaders who send troops overseas, and then theoretically, we're supposed to, you know, keep those. Keep an eye on those elected leaders, hold them accountable, and, you know, make sure that we have coherent war aims and that, you know, we're not sort of fighting war on autopilot, which is sometimes, I think, many veterans, when they come back and feel a kind of disengagement from the American public, I think that's very hard for them.
Mm-hmm. As people will read your book from what the reviews are saying and consider this the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan as well, you have read certain kinds of books, and I was interested in what you have chosen as particularly Joseph Conrad's book that was personally touching to you, that you thought that it spoke to you in a way that was perhaps universal.
I mean, that's the beautiful thing about literature in general, right? You're reading about an experience that is radically unlike yours, and you know, in a place and time far away, and yet, you know, you read it and you go, this may be about a 18th century Russian aristocrat, but that's me, right? That is what I didn't know I felt until I read it in that book. And then you learn more both about yourself and about other people at the same time. Mm. And so, you know, Conrad was something for me. He's got this incredible way of understanding both individual psychology and also the psychology of people within systems and organizations and organizational ethics and how those affect people's lives. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, obviously going to be tremendously important for me writing about the military.
Right. Well, if you read Redeployment, if you read Tim O'Brien's work, I saw a production at the Milwaukee Rep a few weeks ago of the Iliad, which was a one-man show, and oh, it was a powerful show. At one point, the actor lists all of the wars that have ever taken place, and it goes on and on and on and on. And you read your stories, and you think, oh my gosh, it goes on and on and on and on, and we deploy people, and we deploy them again and again and again. Was part of your aim to make this, why in the world are we doing this all the time statement?
Well, you know, I think that if we if we're going to send people overseas, I think that the least that we owe those peoples is deep and serious thought about what it means on a human level. You know, that's always got to be very much in our mind, the cost of these wars, and also the policies that we enact and how those get played out. You know, there's a story in the book about a foreign service officer who's trying very hard to sort of set up, you know, like get a water treatment plant running, try and rebuild Iraq, and sort of being hamstrung at every turn by the aftermath of a lot of very short-sighted policies.
And setting up a little league team, is that something that was good to do in Iraq or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, that's sort of the ongoing thread in the story, is that there's an American philanthropist who really wants to teach Iraqi children baseball. He thinks this is going to give them all the lessons they need to become a democracy.
Mm. When you went, and I know that you've considered your experience there mild, you saw some pretty awful things, but you were doing public relations work, so it was a different kind of war experience. But
yes.
did you see stuff that you just have a hard time getting rid of? And is it helpful for you to be able to talk about the horrible things that you saw to help get rid of it in your mind?
Well, I think that there were a lot of things I came back from Iraq with that really troubled me or confused me that I couldn't really get a handle on. And it's not so much, you know, traumatic things. I mean, I saw upsetting things. I live near a you know, TQ Surgical, and so, you know, saw a lot of injured people. Mm. But it was also just a lot of the questions about what this whole experience meant, and also what it meant when I came home, you know, because America doesn't look the same after you've been overseas.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about our reluctance to talk about vets, you know, you had this interesting thing to say in a Times piece that you wrote, that you were having mm-hmm. lunch, I believe, with a friend, and she had been a victim of child sexual abuse. And we rarely say to people who have been through that kind of abusive situation, oh, I can't imagine what you've been through. Mm-hmm. And yet she could say to you, I can't imagine what you have been through. Somehow we need to figure out what you've been through and she's been through and talk about what you've been through.
Right. You know, it goes beyond just talking about war, but also how we enter into the kind of difficult, sometimes painful and awkward, and yet nevertheless deeply important conversations about these sorts of topics, and opening that space up for people to feel like they have the ability to discuss and take ownership over, I think, critical issues, particularly because, you know, instead of war is an issue that concerns all of us. We're all a part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, these are our wars, and so we should think about them.
Yeah. And how do you get, as a writer, all the voices? You have 12 different stories in here, and you've got a lot of voices. You've got dialogue, and the book has been acclaimed for being able to really be completely on point with the language. Did you just listen really well? Did you write down what it was people were saying? How do you get the voices of all these soldiers?
You write every story about 15 to 20 times.
Do you really?
Yeah. You do a lot of research. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to vets, doing research, just thinking about it, trying to imagine, and also reading books that weren't necessarily about war, but maybe just books that were wise in certain ways. Edward P. Jones, The Known World, or Wagyu Gali's Beer in the Snooker Club, or, you know, if there's a story from the perspective of a Catholic chaplain, and, you know, reading certain war books like Black Hearts by Jim Frederick were very important, but also reading Georges Bernanos's Diary of a Country Priest, which has nothing to do with war, mm-hmm. and yet was very helpful for starting to kind of I read enough and think enough until I have all these kind of ideas in my head, and then hopefully slowly a voice kind of emerges from that, I guess is the way to say it.
Mm. Well, let's welcome phone calls. The book is new. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read it, but it's going to be a much talked about book. I have this feeling for a long time. Redeployment is the name of the book. Phil Clay is our guest, and it takes people to the front lines of the war in Iraq. What happened there? What happened to soldiers there? And it looks at the larger picture of why we send people to war and what happens when they come back and why it's so hard to get at what this experience has been. And we need to if we're going to formulate policy that will send people to war. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Larry in Pembine is calling for you. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine. How are you, sir?
Doing well, thank you.
Good.
I was listening to the conversation, and being a son of a Marine Corps Korean War veteran, I know all too well of, you know, what haunts these guys day in, day out. My dad used to every night dang near get out and thrash around in his bed and stuff. My ma had to get a separate bedroom, as a matter of fact, because of that. But, you know, what's interesting is I've talked to World War II veterans, and I have quite a few friends that are still in the military. But what troubles me is when I speak to some of the older veterans, and they tell me that what's concerning to them is the fact that some of these guys claim that they're scarred for life because of battle and stuff. And I've seen it firsthand, and had to reiterate to these guys that yes, it is a traumatic experience. And from your own experiences and the people you've talked to, is the Veterans Administration handling and dealing with these things in a correct manner, do you think, sir?
I think we have work to do. I mean, this is, the kind of backlog in the VA and also dealing with issues of mental health, and then the level of suicide among veterans. I think that anytime there's a war, the cost of the war doesn't end when, we bring the troops home, right? I think we're going to be paying for these wars for a long time, and certainly a lot of that cost is going to be borne, by veterans who have been through experiences that are just horrific. So I think there's a lot more work to be done. I think there are very good people in the VA who are trying very hard, but it's a difficult task.
Mm-hmm. How did you answer for yourself why you were there?
Why I was there?
Uh-huh.
I had a job to do, and at the time that I was there, frequently when you talk to people, they'd want to bring it back to the initial invasion, right? Like, should we have gone in or not? But I was there in 2007, right? We weren't out looking for WMDs. We knew they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Anbar province. The Marines that I was with were trying to restore stability to a society that had just been shattered. And there was tremendous violence. Islamic militants were incredibly brutal, incredibly evil. They're still there. And that's just a nightmare for the people in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So the mission that the Marines that I was doing, that I was there with, that was a good mission. We didn't – and – so I certainly – it made sense to me what we were doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We had come in. We had caused this chaos, and we were trying to, set things back on course. And of course, if you follow what's happening in Anbar province right now, it's just incredibly distressing.
Yeah. Oh, it must be so distressing for you particularly, but it is distressing. Thanks, Larry, very much for your call. Mark in Wausau. Hi, Mark. Mark, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, Mark, go right ahead.
Yes. My experience in Iraq, I did 20 years in the National Guard in the state of Wisconsin, and I got called to volunteer to go with a full-time unit. And since you guys, the citizens of the country, paid me to train for 20 years, I figured I better go. And then when I got over there, I got put into a unit to oversee a squad of guys. And the hardest part for me and my men and the whole unit we were with is we'd see Iraqi soldiers walking. Well, they weren't Iraqi. You never knew if they were Iraqi soldiers or who they really were, but they could have guns aiming at us, and we could not do anything to defend ourselves until shots were fired at us. And then you try to explain that to members' families back in the United States, well, your son couldn't defend himself because we have to follow the Geneva Convention and we have to play by these war rules when they weren't. That's the part that the American public needs to understand. If we're going to follow these rules of engagement and the other countries aren't, why are we going there?
Marines talk about counterinsurgency as being a morally bruising battlefield. Exactly what you're saying. It puts service members in a very difficult place because the insurgency hides among the population. The whole point is to disguise themselves so that Americans don't know who's a friend and who's a foe. And it's a very stressful and difficult situation. And I think that's why following the rules of engagement and those things and having clear guidelines was really important. because it was such a chaotic and difficult place for Marines and soldiers and sailors to be in. And you know, at a very low level, I think frequently people don't understand, but at a very low level, you had guys who were making really critical decisions all the time and then having to live with them.
Yeah. Let's talk about Rodriguez for a moment. Marine, he goes to the chaplain, his
right.
company, he believes has lost restraint. They're killing civilians. They're killing insurgents. The only thing I want to do is kill Iraqis, one lance corporal says to the chaplain. Is this kind of an aberration, or does a lot of this happen not only in Iraq but in war?
Well, that's a aberration. I mean, that's a sort of extreme example, right? You have a unit with bad leadership, and certainly, you know, you have bad leadership in different places. But you have a unit with bad leadership, and then a couple, you know, bad battalion commander, bad company commander, and then problems within the platoon and squad, and they're in an incredibly violent place, and bad things happen. It's a constant problem, and that's one of the reasons why you need why good leaders in the Marine Corps are so valuable. Why good military leaders? You know, that story is trying to look at what happens when you have people in that incredibly difficult and morally complicated spot. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. It's not really an aberration in war, right? I mean, you certainly in even wars we like to talk about, like World War II, you certainly had far, far more of that sort of thing than you had in Iraq. But it's something that's probably going to happen in any war of that sort.
Right. Thanks, Mark. Paul in East Troy. Hello, Paul.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm pulling over to the side of the road here. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I also volunteer at the VA hospital in Milwaukee. And I guess I wanted to respond to the first caller's concern and question about how the, I think as you phrased it, how the VA is working with veterans coming from Iraq. And I guess I'd want to say that, first of all, from my experience at VA, the care that our veterans get is incredible. It's caring, it's wonderful, but it is so severely underfunded. And I guess the point that I want to make is that it's not the VA's responsibility necessarily to deal with this. I think it's really society, and to inject a kind of a political note to all this, we have a conservative senator here from Wisconsin who voted against funding for rehabilitation programs for veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan because, quote, we can't afford it. And if you sense I'm getting a little angry from just thinking about that, my gosh, if we're going to send people and put them in harm's way, we should be absolutely certain to make sure that they are cared for by expanding our excellent VA system. Thank you very much.
I think that's an excellent point. The people that I've met in the VA have been phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I think that's a great point about where the responsibility lies.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much. And I know that you have to go, and we're moving in a couple other guests who took this long walk. But what does it mean for you as this writer who's just published this book to be thought of, for this to be reviewed the way that it has, that you're adding to a body of literature that is very, very important literature about war?
I mean, it's a strange experience. I'm very glad that people are reading the book and responding to it. And I mean, that's why I wrote it. I wanted people to engage with the work and have these, you know, opinions about it. And hopefully, I mean, I know that we're going to see more veterans writing. I know there are more books on the way from veterans coming out. And, you know, hopefully the conversation just continues.
I'm sure it will. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Phil Clay, the book is Redeployment, and Phil is really quite a writer. The book, as I said, is getting just very, very wonderful reviews. He's a Dartmouth graduate, veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, served in Iraq during the surge in Anbar province as a public affairs officer. Then he got an MFA from Hunter College. He went to NYU's Veterans Writing Workshop, and his work has been in the New York Times, New York Daily News, Best American Non-Required Reading, and it's called Redeployment. We're going to continue. We're talking about the war experience, particularly the war in Iraq experience, and we'll be speaking with two vets from Milwaukee, Anthony Anderson, who served two tours in Iraq with an Army infantry unit, and we'll speak with Tom Voss, who served on active duty in the U.S. Army for 3 years. They took a 2,400-mile walk from Milwaukee to California, which started last August, and then they were back in Milwaukee in February. Why did they do it? What was the experience like? What was their war experience like? We'll talk with both of them as we continue here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two gentlemen joining us now in our Milwaukee studios. Anthony Anderson served two tours in Iraq with an Army infantry unit, 2004 to 2005 and 2007 to 2008. And Anthony said that his family always stressed the importance of service, and we will talk about his experience in Iraq and also his experience walking, as I said, 2,400 miles. Woo! From Milwaukee to California. Tom Voss is also in our studios in Milwaukee. He served on active duty in the U.S. Army for 3 years, from 2003 to 2006, deployed to Mosul, Iraq, to support Operation Iraqi Freedom. And he'll talk about that experience and this walk that they took, which has been documented. They had some filmmakers with them. Some radio stations picked up on what they were doing. They raised money for Dry Hooch, which we've talked about on our show, a nonprofit Milwaukee organization that serves veterans. Anthony and Tom, thank you both very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
So this is not a small thing that you did. Going to war was no small thing, but let's start with the walk. To walk 2,400 miles from Milwaukee to California, what was the driving force? Why did you want to do this?
I think it started with just a simple phone call from Tom to me requesting a ruck, if I had a ruck he could borrow.
A what?
A rucksack, a backpack.
Oh, okay.
And I asked him, you know, what do you want it for? And he said that he had never really taken the time that he wanted getting out of the military and coming home from overseas, and he wanted to take that time to walk to California and just kind of address his issues. And I said, you know, I kind of feel like I'm in the same boat. Would you mind if I came along? And of course, he said okay, and then we also turned it into a fundraiser for Dry Hooch and an awareness campaign for veterans and their families.
Wow. And what were the issues you wanted to think about, and why was walking the way to think about them?
Well, I felt that, you know, once I returned from, you know, my service in 2006, I was faced with a lot of things like, you know, finding a job, going to school, finding a place to live, and it really kind of pushed you know, some of the traumas that I've experienced out of the way. And that ended up coming back, you know, a few years later. And then I had to seek treatment at the VA hospital for them. So I never really took the time to kind of decompress from my deployment. So I thought that by, you know, walking to California, that would give me a chance to kind of quiet the outside noises of life, basically, and you know, address those issues.
Mm-hmm. And did the two of you talk to each other extensively about what your experiences were?
Yeah, I think prior to the walk, we were both pretty familiar with what each of us was struggling with.
Uh-huh.
And then during the walk, we utilized that time to help not only ourselves, but one another. So there could have been a day where I was struggling a little bit, and Tom would have been my sounding board, and I would throw different ideas off of him, and he would come back and forth with kind of almost like a mentoring approach, and vice versa. And so we were able to do some self-healing, but also kind of team up and help one another. Really, I know it's kind of cliched, but every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. And you met, I understand, quite a few vets along the journey.
I think probably hundreds.
Yeah. Did you,
mm-hmm.
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they would stop you and say, well, they all said something different, but what would they say?
Right. A lot of us would stop and, you know, thank us for what, you know, we're doing, which is, I think, in relation to our awareness campaign. So we tried to, you know, educate the non-veteran community about what veterans are going through, whether it's, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, suicide, homelessness, you know, all the myriad of issues facing them. So we got a lot of veterans thanking us for, you know, kind of stepping out and talking about our own issues. And we got a few veterans that reached out to us and told us that they were, you know, seeking treatment after, you know, 4 or 5 years of trying to deal with it themselves. And now that they're going in to the VA to get care. So that was pretty inspirational.
Yeah, I think people reached out to us from something as simple as seeing us on the side of the road and pulling over. Recognizing us as we walk through their town and kind of running to catch up with us and walking for a while. But I think predominantly people followed us on social media, and then they knew generally where we were, and they would extend an offer to let us sleep at their home or a meal or take a shower, do laundry, something at their home. I think to kind of echo Tom's sentiments, the one way that we knew that we were reaching the veteran community were the number of people that contacted us and said, I never talked to anybody. I never tried to address my issues. I didn't even feel comfortable talking to my family. After reading the blogs on your website, after seeing you guys on the news, after hearing your story, now I'm motivated to do that. So I think that that was pretty inspirational for us as well.
And why is it so hard? We spent some time with our earlier guest talking about how the community that has not experienced war needs to do, that people who have experienced it need to do a better job of just saying what the experience was, and instead of saying, oh, I can't imagine what you've been through, that the civilian community really needs to hear the stories as well, as difficult as they may be to hear them. Is that true, or would you be of the school that believes that you have to have been there or you'll never understand what I've been through?
I think that more and more, myself and Anthony included, we try to be as open as possible with our experience, because, I mean, the only way that the non-veteran community is going to be able to help is if they understand, you know, what we've been through. So we're really open and try to educate the non-veteran community on what we've been through so they have some sort of better understanding and can provide help if necessary.
Mm-hmm. But I also think that it's a predicament to put veterans in that situation where they're explaining their experience. A lot of the people that I served with, including myself, I mean, the first time I went to Iraq, I was 21 years old, and the second time I was 24.
A kid.
So, and I think Tom was 20 or 21.
20. Mm-hmm.
You were 20 years old.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're young. We're still trying to figure out life. And then we have this tremendous, huge life experience in serving in war. And you come back, and people want to know about it. And I think that that's great. But you're trying to figure it out for yourself as well. And not everyone is as articulate as another. So to explain what it was, they might not even know yet. And it takes time. It takes several years. You have a death of a family member or a loss of a job or a breakup of a relationship. There's a lot of emotions that go through you, a lot of thoughts, a lot of what ifs. What if I'd done this? It takes time to work those things out. War is no different. It takes time, it takes reflection, it takes being around other people that have had similar experience where you can kind of go back and forth with that. But I do think it's incredibly hard to try to explain what it is you just did with the last several months or several years of your life.
Right. Well, is there something in place for when you come back so that you can meet with each other, people who have been there and people who want to understand? It sounds like you sort of get thrust into society. Oh, you got to find a job. You got to work out your own life.
It really depends on where you're at.
Really?
Well, let's take Milwaukee for instance. I went to UWM. Tom went to UWM. When I was a student there, there really wasn't. There was a veteran presence, but there really wasn't a widely followed like student veteran group. Now it's improved quite a bit, but I would recognize other veterans just by maybe their pack or a hat they were wearing.
Really?
Or a shirt or something like that. And you kind of have the opportunity to talk to them. Similarly, here in Milwaukee, we have a place like Dry Hooch where veterans can go and get peer-to-peer help in a completely sober and safe environment. But Milwaukee is not every other community.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're talking about, like in Tom's instance, he's active duty, stationed mm-hmm. in Washington State. So when he gets out, he comes back to Wisconsin. Everyone he served with is gone. I was a member of the Guard. My unit might be 50 miles away, but there might be people from that unit from all around the state. So when I come home, I'm the only one in my neighborhood, the only one in the city that I know. Mm-hmm. And so finding those resources, it's not always easy. And then your peers, you're kind of spread to the wind.
Yeah.
That's one of the more difficult things is, you know, separating from the military, and then you have that feeling of isolation, you know, because you don't have anyone who's shared that experience with you. So you kind of feel like almost like an outcast, you know, when you first leave the service.
Yeah.
And I think that's why so many veterans that we met were excited to meet us as we walked, not only because of what we were doing, but just the opportunity to be able to speak that jargon again and be understood, to have someone that they felt knows at least somewhat what they're going through, someone that won't criticize them for feeling the way that they feel, someone that understands that what they went through and what they're feeling, it's complex. It takes time, that we don't hold, you know, their perceived shortcomings against them, that they're trying to work through all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really resonated with a lot of people, and that's why they sought us out.
Mm-hmm. And did you have filmmakers with you? Did I read that there were...
Yeah. We had, in the build-up to the walk, we were reached out to by a group of filmmakers from New York. And they came to Milwaukee and filmed with us before we left. And then they would spend a week to maybe 2 weeks at a time with us and then go back to New York or come back to Wisconsin and catch up with our families to see what they were up to in our absence and then come right back out to us. So they were with us a lot between August and we got done February 1st and they left February 16th or something like that. So they were with us quite a bit.
So what will happen with that film?
They'll turn that into a documentary film.
Wonderful.
Their last film was called Give Up Tomorrow. They won awards all around the world for it, and I know that they put stuff out through like PBS and BBC and different educational academic forums, so I think we'll probably see it sometime next year, but that's up to them.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it was like just to sort of put yourself out there on roads and little communities and just walking so far. And it's a huge thing to do, isn't it? How do you prepare for a trip like that? Psychologically, how do you prepare?
It was almost, there were times when we kind of reflected on it as, you know, getting ready for a deployment. I mean, we, had to make sure all our personal affairs were in order before we left. Make sure that both Anthony and myself had our, you know, our heads in the right place before, you know, we were going to do this. So, it ended up being, you know, a 5-month trek.
And I think people shouldn't think, at least for me, that from the day we did it to the day we got done, there was always this confidence. I mean, there were times before we left where I questioned whether or not I could do it. That was the same thing I went through before I went to Iraq. Is this really what I want to be doing? You know, is this really where I saw myself, what, you know, do I really want to go through these things? And there were times where I like would openly question it to myself, like, can I really do this? I never questioned whether or not I could walk to California. It was whether or not I could meet the expectations of the people that would be watching us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was more concerned about that than my own well-being in most cases.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed that it shows you how good people can be. You only had to sleep outside 10 nights, is that right?
10 or 12, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time people open their homes to you.
That or people would follow us and know we were in an area that had a hotel. And I mean, even people here in Milwaukee, we were in Colorado, and we could call someone that said, if you ever need a hotel room, call me, and we'd call them. They'd find out what city we were in and get us a hotel room for the night, which was great. It's one thing to sleep out in the country. It's another to try to find a place to sleep in a city. When you're out in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska, it's not hard to find a place to sleep outside. We've shared this story, like finding a country cemetery is very accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
No one will bother you. But when you're in, say, Lincoln, Nebraska, if you don't know someone, you can't just pitch a tent in a city park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you tend to have some visitors then that might put you in jail. So you just try to avoid that stuff. But it was nice, the amount of people that would reach out. It also not only was nice for us, but I think it brought some ease to our family, knowing that we were safe and things like that.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. We'll welcome phone calls for both of you in the time that we have. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Tom and Anthony have recently returned from California. They're from Milwaukee, but they walked over 2,400 miles to reflect on their own experience, their tours in Iraq, and also to raise money for Dry Hooch, the nonprofit Milwaukee organization that really serves veterans in a valuable way. Anthony Anderson and Tom Voss are our guests, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are jammed here for you gentlemen, and let's go to Tracy in Spring Green. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for the show, and Tom and Anthony, thank you for serving.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, you talked about your units coming home and then scattering all over the country and not being able to meet and have these meaningful conversations that the two of you had when you walked across the country. Have you or has anyone you know created groups on social media to do just that so that you can, I don't know, Skype with one another or talk, you know, blog with one another so that you can have these conversations with people that were there where you were?
Yeah, I mean, I keep touch with a lot of the guys that I served with on my deployment through Facebook and other social media outlets. But, you know, it took a while to kind of, you know, track everyone down. I mean, it wasn't, you know, in 2006, it wasn't really a priority on my list. But we keep in touch and, you know, we try to check in on each other.
And I think that there are certainly things available for people to do that. It's getting the awareness out there of what's available so they can track it down for themselves. That's one of the things that makes it difficult for veterans is that there are a lot of opportunities, whether they're through the VA or community-based agency or even social media, but they don't know about them and they don't know how they can access them and they don't know if they qualify for them. So I think that if there are things that are available, just letting people know about them and how they can access them would be a great first step.
Mm. Thank you, Tracy, very much for your call. Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
My question for your guests was if they thought that all the expectations that arose after they had planned their walk kind of hampered the original goal of dealing with internal issues.
That is an excellent question, and I honestly think that's the first time we've ever had that asked.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I shared with the documentary director, that when Tom was going to go do this before I got involved, it was going to be one thing. And when I got involved, all of a sudden there was fundraising and awareness campaign and then documentary stuff, and I thought, I'll feel really guilty if the circus keeps Tom from being able to do what he's trying to do. I, too, wanted to try to address my own stuff, but it was a different expectation, I think, for me. I don't think overall it took away from it. As a matter of fact, I think in some ways it enhanced our ability to address our issues because of the amount of people that sought us out and the amount of people that we spoke with. But I think as far as expectations, it just kind of kept us in line, like making sure we were achieving our goal no matter how much frustration was building up with us over the course of the walk, because it did get frustrating sometimes.
Mm. Well, it probably focused you in a way, too, that you had to be on your toes, perhaps?
Well, I think it focused us, certainly, but I think sometimes it also overrode maybe the goal for the day.
Mm.
You know, like there'd be times where we'd have, okay, we got to walk 25 miles tomorrow, but then we'd have a radio interview and then a news interview and a television interview. And they would say it'll take a half an hour, and it would take 45 minutes, then an hour and a half, then
right,
2 hours.
Right.
This is time now. Instead of walking 9 or 10 miles in that amount of time, we're still at square one. And so sometimes it was frustrating.
You should have just said, "Bring your darn recorder and walk with us."
We did sometimes.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah.
And what were some of the you just sort of in passing mentioned some of the frustrations you had to deal with on the walk? What were those?
Well, I think the route that we had intended to walk, we were able to stay on a lot, but every now and then things come up. In places like Wisconsin and Iowa and Nebraska, everything is based on a grid system. So if a road ends, you can find another road relatively easily. You just go left or right and you're going to find one. Once you get into areas like southern Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, it doesn't work that way. And there's additional complications of a number of Indian reservations. That one might be on one side of the road and the other may be on immediately on the other side of the road. One can allow you to walk on it. The other says no. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you're on the interstate, say the distance between point A and point B might be 20 miles. Well, we can't walk on the interstate, and so the route we have to take might be 35 or 40 miles. And so there are frustrations in that way that we're – I think we anticipated them, but when they finally are right there and presented to you, they're no less frustrating.
Yeah. Did you have it all mapped out, Tom, every day and all the routes that, as well as you could –
Yeah, we sat down, and I think over 8 or 9 hours, we literally sat down with paper maps and, you know, double-checking that, and we planned out our route starting from, you know, California back to Wisconsin. So, I mean, we tried to use Google Maps to verify that roads were still there, and sometimes even when we did that, they weren't. So
yeah. The bridge would be washed out. Yeah. I remember in Iowa, a bridge was washed out, so we had to walk on the train tracks to get around it for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just things like that.
Yeah. It's things that you never thought you would do in your life. Thank you, Bob. Let's go to Casey in Green Bay. Hi, Casey.
Well, good afternoon. How are you guys today?
Good. Great. Thank you.
I want to thank you for what you did for our country, and I consider you our country's greatest generation now that the World War II veterans are going the way of the past. But you know, you talk about how we could get men and women today to maybe ask for help or seek help or get together with other men and women. Please encourage them to join veteran service organizations like the American Legion, AMVETS, Disabled American Veterans, the VFW, Military Order of the Purple Hearts. Not only are these organizations begging you men and women to join them, they're also the organizations to go to Congress virtually on an everyday basis to make sure that you got the benefits you were guaranteed when you went in the military, not just today, but 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road. There's also an excellent organization that started here in Wisconsin about 6 years ago. It's called Desert Vets of Wisconsin, and I strongly encourage all men and women that served from the First Gulf War up to today to join Desert Vets of Wisconsin. You can go to their website, desertvetsofwisconsin.org. Those are the organizations that are going to be fighting for you in the future to make sure you get the benefits that you were promised.
Thank you, Casey. I would imagine those kinds of organizations are very important.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We've received tons of support from these kinds of organizations, VFWs, American Legions, along the way. Mm-hmm. You know, they took us in. We had post commanders from VFWs, you know, house us. And so they are important organizations. Yeah. I totally agree.
Let's go to Dean in Atlantic, Iowa. Hi, Dean.
Hey, how's it going?
Is this Dean Barber?
I think you know him.
How are you doing, Dean?
All right, let us in. Who's Dean?
Dean was a gentleman that we met on our way through Iowa who gave us Pedialyte and snacks and kind of sought us out to give us the help that he could give us. So he was one of many generous people that sought us out to make sure that we were taken care of for that day.
Nice. That was nice, Dean. And anyway, go ahead, sir.
What's that?
Go ahead.
I was just wanting to throw in to Tom and Anthony that because of my back, I can't walk very much. I would have loved to join you guys as you passed through, but I just couldn't do it. So I helped out as best I can. But the way I've found, and this is just me personally, to help ease the transition from when I got out until now, I got involved with a lot of community efforts via the VFW. I'm the local commander of the VFW here in Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of community work, and that got me out there, got me meeting people, and, you know, just open up the circle of friends, and that helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could just throw that out there.
Sure, and if I could actually build on what Dean is saying, that a message that Tom and I had from before we left on the walk up till now is involvement in the community, especially non-veteran community. The veterans have so many skills and so many talents that they had before the military that maybe they learned in the military or were enhanced by the military, that I know I can throw myself in this group that when they got done in the military, they rejected a lot of them.
Mm.
They didn't want anything to do with them anymore. They kind of just wanted to separate entirely from that. But in one way of doing this walk, I found that a lot of these things that I was rejecting were actually very useful if I just kind of repackaged them and repurposed them for what I was doing. Involvement in your community is something that I think every veteran has done by their service. But I think that service doesn't end when you take the uniform off, and that it's just another great way to demonstrate the value of the veteran to every community. And so I think Dean is spot on.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. Thanks so much for your call. Do you have a website or something? We're out of time.
Sure. www.veteranstrek.com.
Veteranstrek.com.
Yep. You can find us on Facebook, Veterans Trek, Twitter, at Veterans Trek, Instagram, Veterans Trek.
Oh, you guys are
all
so tech savvy.
We're all tapped in.
Yes, you are. Yep. Thank you. Thank you both so much for being with us. Anthony Anderson and Tom Voss. Again, it's VeteransTrek.com for more information about their extraordinary journey. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show, and to KP as well for on air in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls and listening. You can also carry on the conversation on Facebook. And our site is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for listening. And this is the Ideas Network.